Here we are again. Recognise some faces. Always the old disconnect, etc. You're now bold, brave second years at the University of Lincoln doing a combination or journalism single or journalism and creative writing and so on, which is fantastic and great. And what we're going to do over the next 3 months or thereabouts is take you through, as the name of the module suggests, a kind of general outline of histories of journalism, as I said sort of last year in the kind of the options meeting, which hopefully might begin to unpick some of the ways in which we're in the condition that we find ourselves today. Humbug, or not, as the case may be. Don't worry too much about making notes and trying to copy down everything I'm saying during the lecture, which will pretty much take place in the first hour, because basically I'll be making all the lectures available as podcasts, so you can actually download them, listen again at your leisure, etc. So don't, as I say, go through my sound. Rather, hopefully, you kind of pick up on some of the overall themes. By all means, take some notes down, but you know, don't overstress as far as that's concerned. And then the second part of our joyous experience of 7,200 seconds, that's when it become a bit more interactive, and we'll still talk more about how things are developing and how we can learn by dialogue, learn by discourse, and so on and so forth. I'll also go through some of the mechanics of the module as well in the second part when we go into the seminar time from that perspective onwards. So I'd like to start by basically considering this whole notion of, as you can see there, post-war Britain and post-World War II Britain in particular. Okay, start off with a little bit of interactivity. Could you put your hand up if you could identify the name of the gentleman who's there? And it is?
Winston Churchill.
Excellent, excellent. Whose grandson is?
Just been fired.
Well, interesting, his name was Just Been Fired Churchill, wasn't it, really? But not quite. Nicholas Soames, yes, who works through various other bits and pieces. And there's a lot of kind of things which will go back and forth over this. And the whole notion of histories of journalism, we can really start at any particular time, but we choose to really start in the post-war period because this is where what we now refer to as contemporary journalistic things really started developing and evolving and so on. And I'd like to start by sort of considering the notion that actually the Second World War was extremely expensive, highly expensive. It was expensive in terms of lives. There were over 500,000 people who actually died. And also it created a huge, monumental national debt. In fact, it wasn't until really the beginning of this century that our borrowings from the United States of America were finally settled as far as the Second World War is concerned. You know, we basically had to borrow substantially just to effectively succeed in that particular aspect. And after the war itself, the country basically continued to live beyond its means. Rationing was still in place until pretty much the mid-1950s. And pretty much the entire infrastructure had crumbled in so many ways and forms as well. And this rather ironic image that we've got of the newly elected Clement Attlee and the surprising sort of victory that he'd actually had over Winston Churchill, the Labour Party, kind of shows that challenge that he was faced with the lion rampart in the background there having to walk across a tightrope in terms of how things were operating and so on and so forth. As I say, the infrastructure was pretty much devastated. Factory equipment had become worn out, it was outmoded, and millions of buildings had been destroyed, and there was no money at all available for repairs. So, to use the vernacular, the country was up the creek without a paddle. Flip side, the United States was booming. Massive success. It was also swallowing up overseas markets, something we'll come across very much as the module develops, and we'll see how that really impacted in terms of, obviously, globalisation and so on. And it was buying other markets overseas in order to export, obviously, the notion of Americanism. Consumerism, kind of key thing. Heart of consumerism is, if you're feeling a bit blue and low, buy stuff. And if you still feel it blue, buy more stuff, and so on and so forth. And again, we'll talk a bit more about that as we develop, etc. And the United States, because obviously the kind of, you know, impact of the war, but had been paid substantially to do that, had swallowed up a whole range of overseas markets as well to support her own massive spending in terms of the industry, etc. Flip side, Europe, pretty difficult to compete with that. Obviously, from the point of view of either the quote-unquote victors, Britain and allies, and of course, Europe itself from that point of view. Now, Britain itself was still what would be regarded as a superpower. It still had an awful lot of prestige. It had a military presence in over 40 countries. But it didn't have the money to actually back it up. Okay? So it's massively overstretched. Yes, there is still an acknowledgeable British Empire. But compared to what it had been at the start of the 20th century, it was very, very thinly spread. Hence the term special relationship, which hopefully most of you will have encountered in some way, shape or form. First, probably again, really revisited with Tony Blair and George Bush again at the start of the 21st century. And of course the Iraq War, and referred to, you know, regularly since then. Arguably the whole notion of the blonde on blonde, big Trump, mini Trump, etc. is a kind of extension on one level of that, although again lots of issues to debate with respect to that. America effectively lent huge sums of money, as I mentioned, just to prop up the British economy. What were they asking for in return? Well, unequivocal support on all foreign issues. So in essence, it was a line that was pretty much taken that where America wanted to go, Britain would effectively meekly follow. There is one situation that kind of impacts this, which I'll talk about in the course of this lecture as well. But this new relationship with America was inevitably going to have a huge impact on what we regard as British culture. Especially providing a driving force and a motivation for something which really started to emerge in the post-war period and arguably up to the present day, the phenomenon of the teenager. Yeah, pretty much prior to 1940, teenagers didn't exist, really. You kind of went to school and you went to work, so you went from child to adult, and that's it, basically. There's no kind of interim period with disposable income and so on. There were sort of issues that were relating to that, but again opened up a whole variety of other elements as well. However, Britain had won the war. And there was a glow of victory, obviously, VE Day, VJ Day, etc. I mean, you may have caught in the papers over the summer that we kind of moved from 80 years since war broke out, you know, with obviously celebrations and lines from that point of view. But it ultimately probably papered over the cracks. It papered over how weak and dependent on the United States Britain had actually become as a country. Many folk would look back on the Second World War with pride and nostalgia, kind of notion of we went through the darkest hours, etc. The country had pulled together, stood together through its darkest hours, it had proved its worth. And Winston Churchill, who we started off the slides with, gathered a team of historians to write a history of the Second World War, for which he actually won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1956. Now, the book itself arguably massages some of the facts, as you'd expect. There is a line that history is written by the victors. It was still a bestseller, and it helped to reinforce this image of wartime courage and wartime morality that, in essence, people still now use the rhetoric of looking back as representative of Britain and British character and characteristics. People were constantly being reminded of the war through books, newspaper articles, films, movies, lots of war movies, characters in comics, toys, television documentaries, all fueling this market about almost a mythical story in many ways, and a war of heroes, a people's war. For those who were growing up in the 1950s, i.e. the beginning of the onset of the post-war generation, the baby boomers and so on, this nostalgia was becoming somewhat stifling and dull. The post-World War world was also entering a whole new era, the nuclear age, and of course the Cold War, which effectively stretched from the end of the Second World War pretty much until the onset of the 1990s or the late 1980s. This notion of MAD, mutually assured destruction, that if both sides actually have the nuclear bomb, the atom bomb, etc., you would destroy the planet and so on. And lots of, again, spy scandals and aspects coming through that have been played out in so many narratives and dramas and movies as well from that point of view. And that nuclear threat certainly gave teenagers, and probably your grandparents, possibly parents, most likely grandparents, a very different take on the world. Leading in the 1960s to a clash between mainstream culture and counterculture. It's interesting that a lot of things that we now see today in terms of extinction agenda, in terms of climate change and so on, the whole note of ecological awareness began to grow and evolve within the 1960s. It's one of those sort of areas where there were a whole series of changes, as we'll see when we go on to consider that decade, in a whole series of things from that point of view. That probable clash between mainstream culture and counterculture arguably owes a great deal to a reaction by the young, and we're talking about teenagers and so on, under 20s and possibly just early 20s, against this romanticising of the Second World War and also its consequences. After the war, in 1955, understandably, British people wanted some kind of payback for their efforts. Now, the government had, the coalition government, led by Churchill, of course, had kept morale high with promises of a better world, a new Jerusalem, the notion of jam tomorrow, but never jam today. Carrying on. And expectations were high that, we're not interested in the fact that financially you haven't got a penny to spend. We actually want to have a government that delivers on these expectations, a country fit for heroes. One of the reasons that apparently shocking result now of our wartime leader Winston Churchill and the Tory party being voted out of office and the first major Labour party being entered into place was kind of a reaction against that. Labour had actually promised jobs, it had promised housing, it had promised a National Health Service and a great deal of other public services. Accordingly, it had a landslide victory in the general election of 1945 with a 146-seat majority. 146 seats. Kill for that these days. And the new Prime Minister, who we can see there, Clement Attlee, managed to carry through an immense legislative programme on the back of that. And some of the key points that I put there in terms of his acts were very much the four. The National Insurance Act. And they should have actually having a society which didn't have people who effectively, once you reach a certain age, that's it, it's time to check out of the oxygen habit and check into the wooden Waldorf or whatever. Nye Bevin, who set up the National Health Service in 1946. Again, often used currently as a political football for a variety of reasons, etc. And the National Assistance Act all effectively created the framework for what we now refer to as a welfare state. Something which actually, again, had a consensus and a consensus politics in terms of actually, yes, in a civilised society, we need to have these things in place to ensure that there is genuine equality and so on. Fuel, i.e. coal, oil, and so on, electricity, power, transport, and the Bank of England were all nationalised, again with the express intention of creating full employment. However, and there always is a kind of forever, the books didn't actually balance. Britain still continued to import more goods than she actually exported. And that led in 1947, 2 years after the war had ended, supposedly, to a major currency crisis. Sterling was devalued in 1949, which meant higher prices and public spending cuts. And of course rationing, which basically limited the amount of foods you could actually consume, the amount of clothing that was available, all that kind of notion of rationing and ration books and so on, still remained in place. So again, what has changed? People could actually go to the cinema and they could actually admire the clothes and fringes and lifestyles of our cousins in the United States. And there's an awful lot of United States product flooding the cinema now from Hollywood and so on, which is opening up musicals and seeing wonderful magical worlds, etc., in Technicolor and so on. But a bit like a child who presses their nose up against a sweet shop or a toy shop window, they could look, but they couldn't have any of it. This, in essence, for Britain, was very much the age of austerity. It was a world in which, in essence, the population who had effectively denied themselves everything through the war actually needed to manage on even less. Sorry, there's no money. The government actually set limits on what manufacturers were allowed to sell at home, purely so they could actually concentrate on exports. Now, we're not asking you to be financial journalists here, but basically that was simply a case of balancing the books, making sure that you're selling more than you're effectively buying. Simple as that. So even if you could afford a car, or indeed a washing machine, or any white good, etc., and you said, I'm going to go and buy that, you're not going to get it immediately, because you had to put your name on a waiting list before things even sort of opened up on that basis. Understandably, that was all very damaging to the Labour government, who quickly lost the middle class vote and the women's vote as well. And they pretty much struggled on from 1947 to 1951 with a much smaller majority, and were finally pushed out of office in 1951 for another 13 years. Because they promised so much, overpromised if you like, and ultimately couldn't really deliver in terms of where things are going. Similar kind of metaphor we're sort of using in terms of today, and the fear of, oh, well, you know, Boris is insane, but what about Jeremy Corbyn? He's even more insane, etc., etc. Big challenges. Thankfully, we actually haven't had a war, which is good. The last initiative of the Labour government, the post-war Labour government, took place in 1951, and it was what you see on your screen there, the Festival of Britain. It was based in the South Bank, and it was intended to bring tourists to Britain. It was intended to increase morale at home. A lot of the lines that were being used by the press and the way that we're describing this and what we were producing or was being produced, very similar to the arguments for the 2012 London Olympics and the Millennium Dome, in fact. You know, the whole aspect of having something we can be proud of from that point of view. It was also designed to increase morale and to be a showcase for developments in science, in technology, in the arts, in industrial design and so on. And it basically ran for 5 months within London and worked through that basis. It was seen primarily as a public relations exercise. It was a way of showing to the world that Britain was getting back on her feet, throwing off the shackles. It was very successful. 8 million people actually came to the Festival of Britain and so on. And there were events that were held all over the country as part of the festival. The high point was actually the opening of the Royal Festival Hall with a programme of English music. And the pleasure gardens at Battersea Park also offered fairground rides for the less discerning, Hoi Polloi and so on. But, as ever, being British, the event had its critics. Cost £11 million. That's a huge amount. You know, you're talking comparative terms, probably the high side of around about 500 million or thereabouts these days, maybe a little bit less than that. That, in the circumstances where the country is basically still near bankruptcy, is a massive amount to actually invest in things. It also puts so much pressure on London's power supply that many parts of the capital were actually plunged into darkness because the electrical infrastructure could not cope. The pleasure gardens actually opened late because of go slows and work to rules by the actual construction workers, who understandably wanted higher rates of pay. And there were a range of aspects that sort of again fed into that notion that, is this a white elephant? Is this a disaster? What we were doing with respect to this whole side of things? Certainly when the Conservatives came in 1951, the Festival of Britain effectively was shut down and was then basically left to fall to pieces for a decade. The main site that we saw in the opening slide was used for an office block and car park, which basically left that as the sole representation of where the Festival of Britain had actually been, that wonderful, or not, depending on your views on architecture, Royal Festival Hall in, again, 1951. Now, when you look at that building, flickering through the gloom and so on, you pretty much see something which kind of epitomises to the external world, to ourselves, where Britain had kind of changed from the 19th century and the whole essence of what was seen there as the heart of empire to the 20th century. You have an architectural structure which can be best described as modernist, it can be seen as austere, it can be seen as concrete and brutalist. And just compare what you've got there with the more delicately framed aspects of the Houses of Westminster, Big Ben, so on, just up the river from that point of view. So big change in terms of what we're seeing as a kind of vision of the future. Is this Britain? This is the period where, of course, George Orwell has written 1984, you know, the whole notion of a stark totalitarian state, kind of parodying Stalinist Russia and so on, a whole range of aspects relating to that. Where's the heart? Is this a symbol of the new world order? Now, the Conservatives or Tory Party effectively promised more prosperity, as they tend to do. And they also promised to cut bureaucracy, as they tend to do, as most politicians, for that matter, tend to do. But it would still take them pretty much the whole duration of the 1950s, i.e. 10 years, to achieve the free market consumer paradise that middle-class Americans were already enjoying as a matter of, you know, born right, etc. In the meantime, rationing continued until 1954, and there was lots of spam on the menus. Spam, 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 spam. In the words of Monty Python, even more spam than spam. Has anybody here ever had spam? Spam fritters? Two. Yeah, well, we may be going back to that, so who knows. Children would play on bomb sites. Hey, there's a bit of interactivity there, you know. Somebody say, oh, look, there's my grandfather. Doing a whole range of sort of activities, so health and safety, please look away. Families would be struggling to cope with inadequate housing. Life, in the main, was pretty dull and pretty boring, okay, but at least there wasn't any war. At least you weren't faced with bombing raids on a nightly basis by V2 rockets, V1s, and so on. And actually, the flip side was that life was broadly secure. There were plenty of jobs. There was, of course, healthcare, and indeed, there were also pensions. In terms of some of the numbers, there were 700,000 homes that were actually lost during the war years. And the Tories under Winston Churchill at first proved very successful in the 1950s at replacing them. Now, they can also be criticised for ignoring other problems. Problems that, again, would come back to actually haunt successive governments. Immigration controls being one of those aspects. Trade union legislation, another key one. Welfare. General standards of education. However, the one thing you can say about the Tory government during this time was they did build houses. And by 1953, significant year, any reasons why 1953 is a significant year? It's when we became, as a country, Elizabethans again. It's when Queen Elizabeth effectively was crowned Queen Elizabeth II because her father had obviously passed on. And we're heading through that. It's a coronation year. Major important sort of time from that. And who knows what will be happening again in future years. But by 1953, the government were building annually 300,000 new homes. Although it has to be said that in many cases, the quality of those homes tended to suffer because of the drive to actually just put them up and stack them up in quantity and so on and so forth. The 1950s and 1960s broadly saw a whole range of building booms. Actually, it's fair to use the term unprecedented in terms of what we were seeing here. Look, Milton Keynes, the initial plan there, flickering through the whole system. And in terms of that whole sequence, it changed the way not only that the country looked, because we're also seeing a huge motorway expansion and infrastructure on that basis, but also the way that people lived. There were new towns. There was new housing. High-rise flats. And also unprecedented demolition. This notion that actually somehow everything that was old or Victoria, etc., had to be demolished, wiped out, build new, etc., etc. So why? Key question. I put this to any undergraduate student, but especially journalism or creative writing folk or journalism folk, to actually go through this. Why was this the case? Ask why. Well, actually, there were two reasons. Firstly, they actually needed a new infrastructure to accommodate existing traffic and indeed existing population areas, etc. But they also needed to enable councils to actually increase the rates and local taxes and so on, because the more people are living in their own homes and owning their own homes, then the more taxes they can actually pay for local services and so on. This is pre-council tax, of course. But in terms of paying the rates, as they used to be referred to, you know, that obviously is an income stream. So again, an aspect that's worth considering. Many people would actually call this slum clearance. They would actually sort of say it was licensed vandalism in one or two cases, because local authorities and developers weren't actually very concerned about what they pulled down. For instance, does anybody know where this wonderful piece of Gothic architecture actually was situated? It was in London. And it was actually demolished in 1963 to make way for that. Okay? So again, you've got that interesting line. You have a shift there, which clearly is almost forcibly pushing into the 20th century and sort of arguing from that point of view. There were huge protests when the Gateway to the North Arch effectively was demolished, but it still went because obviously Euston Station needed to be expanded, developed from that point of view. Between 1959 and 1975, listed buildings, which are generally regarded as historical and worthy of that, were pretty much being demolished at the rate of one per day. So that's 365 a year. 366, obviously, in a leap year. Most of those buildings were being developed for new roads to actually ensure that, obviously, the car, which, of course, we're all going to depend upon and use phenomenally well because it's not going to have any impact at all on our routines, is clearly the go-to form of transport and so on. Let's actually move on from the point of view of the railways right the way through to, let's take Birmingham, for example. You can see, again, changes that have worked through there. Interestingly enough, the Bullring is obviously getting developed, etc. But the Bullring was cited as very much the triumphal nature of modernity. And modernity, that whole notion of the modern era, not the postmodern era, but the modern era, is very much seen as, together with the car, triumphantly moving over what was the old world. Things were changing. You know, things were adjusting from that point of view. As we said, the concrete architecture that was being used to develop these kind of things was often seen as being brutal. It was seen about being austere. It was also seen about building more for less. And inevitably you get a whole range of challenges that impact on that. As you build more housing for less and less, you run risks of quality, standards, etc. And no matter what you end up with, you could eventually actually result in having a disaster on your hands, as we'll see in a few moments. From that point of view there, just flicking through this, it's interesting, this one. Anybody ever see the Michael Caine movie Get Carter? That was a listed building on the basis of that, but has since been demolished. It's the Gateshead car park that was actually there. Is there a Mr. Carter in the house? Get there. I take it you haven't seen the Sylvester Stallone remake? No, very good. The communities living in Britain may well have actually gained more roads, they may have gained more schools, they may have gained new amenities. But generally at this period of time you feel that there's a sense of a loss of community, a sense of a loss of identity. You could argue that this is the moment where we start moving as a country into looking longingly at the past while staggering backwards into the future. Modernisation somehow created also an appearance of desolation, which in its own way you can see as being almost as bad as the bombed out cities that were actually there. Where's the character and so on? Again, let's look at the onset of the motorways. 25-year period between 1950 to 1975, motorways effectively consumed over 25,000 acres of agricultural land. In 1963, the Beeching Report was singularly responsible for also pretty much changing the face of railways throughout the land. It removed 5,000 stations, 5,000 railway stations, which would normally have enabled you to actually travel through all sorts of parts of, say, Lincolnshire, North Hykeham and so on, as an infrastructure that had already been working, was scrapped. Because it was basically felt that actually, why would people want to travel in a mass transit service which was efficient and regular when they've got the car? Over 3,000 miles of track, railway tracks, were abandoned. Some of these things have emerged. If you've ever attended or been on one of these steam engine areas, etc., that you actually see those sort of working. That's very occasionally you get groups of people get together and kind of reinvigorate that. But it basically meant you had 20,000 acres of derelict land. There was a huge derelict landscape of Victorian factories and yards. Actually, we're kind of here, I mean, sort of the latter part of the 20th century, obviously, but this particular land itself was pretty much toxic waste, a toxic waste dump back in the 1980s, 1990s and beforehand, until they said, let's build a university on here. If you're in a certain period of time, you can actually probably see the glow of radioactive waste seeping through the pine. No, I'm only kidding.
Oh, no.
Between 1947 and 1980, over half of the woods in England were actually chopped down. Now, you could say, isn't that HS2 all over again? I don't know. I mean, again, it's a debate to be had with respect to how effective HS2 is going to be. Yes, it might be a phenomenally prestigious and wealth-generating opportunity, but what will it actually do in terms of the actual effectiveness of the whole thing? There was still a range of a kind of feeling of decline that, well, okay, we'd won the Second World War, but where were we heading in terms of various other things? Was this the future? Was this where we were sort of saying, okay, fine, stack them high, feed them in the boxes, little boxes, and they all ticky-tacky just the same as the song of the time, one of the songs at the time actually went. There was certainly a notion that there was a failure in inner-city urban life, and again, we'll talk a bit about that. There was social conflict. There was also cultural disconnection on the new estates and the new towns. It also, as I mentioned, brought a wave of nostalgia for a lost past. Communities would campaign to save their buildings, their towns, areas of outstanding national beauty, against what they perceived as the developers and those brutalist architects. And again, we'll talk about that and changes as well. We're focusing very much today on Britain, solely Britain. We'll talk about the international picture in future weeks and so on. But bottom line is, in the 1950s, despite occasional disasters like that in the 1960s, you had a scenario where primarily people wanted housing and they got housing. Whether that had been made again like this, and you could draw some parallels between the Ronan Point collapse in 1968 and the Grenville Tower issue again just in recent years, but there was still that sense, well, we're doing it, we're responding to you, etc. And then, of course, in 1953, Winston Churchill suffered a stroke. He struggled on until 1955 as Prime Minister, and the press at the time, in something which I suspect would not occur today, effectively played down the gravity of his ill health. They didn't basically alert people to how unwell he actually was. But after 6 months of basically being considered unfit for office, he retired in 1955, finally died in 1965, but he was replaced by Anthony Eden. Now, Anthony Eden was obviously presiding over derelict lands, Prime Minister, various other things, etc. There he is, obviously establishment, pillar of the establishment there. You can tell that because we have him in front of the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation microphone, and so on. And remember, at this stage, this was the sole mass media outlet as far as television and radio was concerned. There were no commercial stations, either from the point of view of radio or television, etc. Again, interesting debate to be had with respect to that, as we'll work on to that. Now, Anthony Eden was a great statesman, it's generally argued. He had a wartime reputation. He'd actually served as foreign secretary. So he basically sort of was kind of the right person for the job, it was generally felt. He did have one or two health problems, but the Conservatives as a party and as a government still remained as popular as ever. Until 1956. And a thing that basically was launched by this gentleman. And it's the Suez Crisis. If you remember, I said a few moments ago, I was going to talk about how America and Britain had this special relationship, and basically Britain had to do everything that America said, etc. Well, 10 years after, there was maybe a sense that actually, maybe we should actually do something else. I'll explain a bit about the Suez Crisis. It's probably one of the most important and controversial episodes in modern British history. It not only resulted in deep political and public divisions in Britain, but it also caused international uproar. So what was it about? And why did President Nasser, Gamal Nasser, have such a key part to play in terms of this, as you can see, the notion of Egypt's premier Nasser from that point of view? Well, Egypt was a British protectorate. So that meant it wasn't a colony, but effectively Britain would look after it. Okay, look after the admin, look after the coordinates and various other bits and pieces. And Egypt itself had actually gained independence back in 1936. So it's like one of the early sort of areas that said, I'm sorry, we can govern ourselves, thank you, we're off. However, British troops would still remain in Egypt, ostensibly to protect vital interests. And one of those vital interests, of course, is oil and access points from that point of view. In 1954, Colonel, as he was then, Colonel Gamal Nasser, became president of Egypt. Now, he is generally seen, perhaps quite rightly, as an influential moderniser. He was a nationalist. He was also the first president of the United Arab Republic. Now, all is well, so to speak, except for one thing, that both Britain and America governments had actually reneged on an argument to help fund the Aswan Dam project in Egypt, which was seen by Nasser as basically a really critical piece of infrastructure to obviously improve the quality of life for Egypt and so on, and generate energy and so on. Why did they both renege on the Aswan Dam project? Well, partly because they couldn't afford it, but also because politically they felt that Egypt, in fact they understood that Egypt was buying arms from the Soviet Union, which they then suspected were going to be used against Israel, and so you get that whole notion of the domino effect in terms of we're not going to help you build the Aswan Dam whilst you're buying arms from the Soviet Union, and so on and so forth. Colonel Nasser's response to the loss of funding was quite simple. He nationalised the Suez Canal. So a point of egress and access from Europe to Asia and oil fields and so on was basically pinched off completely. Britain and France both relied heavily on the Suez Canal for oil supplies. No canal, no oil. And after a lot of international discussion, both Britain and France, obviously feeling we can do this, they decided to go it alone, and with the backing of Israel, they invaded Egypt. Disaster. Anthony Eden was trying to present himself as a defender of the British Empire. But the action was condemned wholeheartedly by the United Nations. And the United States, who were somewhat alarmed by the rise in what they saw was European aggression, and what looked very much like France and Britain becoming back to the old imperial powers where they could sort the world out between them and so on, very much responded by threatening to create a currency crisis. Thousands protested in Trafalgar Square, and Anthony Eden was forced to back down and withdraw his troops. In three words, Britain was humiliated. Not only were they ill-prepared for the actual invasion itself, they couldn't see it through, it was completely condemned, it was pointless. You might say, isn't that Gulf War I, Gulf War II, an invasion of Iraq? You begin to see, hopefully, there are lots of areas that tend to resonate as we head through the module, etc. The Suez Crisis has, from our contemporary perspective, been regarded as the end of Britain's role as one of the world powers. Because if you can't cope with the Suez Canal, I mean, it's a bit like Manchester United not being able to beat Rochdale, you know, without penalties. Oh, they did it. Then Tottenham didn't against Colchester. Lord. You know, it's that kind of significant sort of aspect, probably even worse than that. And so it's seen as the beginning of the end of what we now refer to, or what's considered very much to be, the British Empire. The whole operation basically revealed in glorious technicolor, or monochrome, if you're looking at sort of newsreels and so on, just how weak Britain had actually become. Also, on a world stage, Britain lost her moral authority to intervene in world affairs. It couldn't even use the line of being something that the United States took on the mantle of, the world's police officer, making sure that people were put in place. And because effectively you're being backed by an Arab state, or backed against an Arab state by Israel, you've kind of lost any kind of sense of morality at all. You know, big issues there. And obviously weak, because at the end of the day, you know, history is rewritten by the victors. Britain was actually forced to withdraw from the area of Egypt, and the Suez Canal crisis developed. British morale effectively was shattered on one level. Actually, to the person in the street, the ordinary man and woman in the street, didn't really matter too much. Somehow kind of insulated from that. But in terms of the geopolitical discussions of the time, big, big problems. And broadly speaking, it led to that decision that in future, British foreign policy could only be agreed with American diplomatic support. So if America doesn't agree with what you're looking to do and you have to run everything past America first, forget it. You're not going to work on that basis. That's the way it is. Anthony Eden, as Prime Minister, was now either too ill or exhausted to actually cope. And so he took advantage to effectively step down from Prime Minister and recuperated in Jamaica. And he stayed at the house of a certain gentleman called Ian Fleming, who you may actually recall was responsible for a certain misogynist character, as he now portrayed, called James Bond, creator of. And when Anthony Eden effectively returned in 1957, there were various press headlines which said, oh, Prime Minister visits, and so on. He basically felt that was too much. He would resign. Anthony Eden's successor was Harold Macmillan. And he tried to very much set a much more cheerful note. Britain, in the words of Macmillan, had never had it so good. Let's forget about this. Let's focus on the positive. And actually, there is a line for saying that. Let's move through that whole system. Interesting, if you look at this protest against the whole routine, law, not war. It would be ignored by Dominic Cumming, I think, these days, and Boris, etc. They just say humbug. In many ways, though, that line by Macmillan was actually true. You know, as I say, we weren't being bombed on a regular basis. There was a development that even with this astounding war, it wasn't a war in which people lost lives, much from that point of view. Life magazine at the time, effectively sort of, you know, looking at the wrap-up of the astounding war, etc. It's kind of like a non-entity. You know, it's like they turned up and said, oh, we'll go home again now, etc. So, you know, it didn't sort of magnify into a huge problem. But it did lead to this little image, which again we'll go on to talk about in a few moments. Britain in this period, and we're talking start of the 1960s now, could be seen as a crowded, urbanised society. 80% of the population were living in cities, okay? Which obviously 20% weren't, but 80% were living in cities. The economy was finally booming. Unemployment was low. Wages were rising. Consumption was rising. And people were, in general, healthier, better educated, better housed. You no longer had to put your name on a waiting list for a car or a domestic appliance. Fashions were becoming more available. And it looked, or began to look, as if the American dream of self-fulfillment through consumption had finally arrived. And we can see in this particular image here, it's worth sort of considering, Harold Macmillan standing next to, who's that man there? JFK, John F. Kennedy. And a really interesting snapshot in terms of this, because where are the wonderful visions of empire. Where are the kind of Romanesque Stoic towers, etc.? It's Washington. It's there, pointing the way to the future in many ways. And it's America. Yeah, clearly, perhaps regrettably some might say, 2 years after this, Kennedy was assassinated, a whole new ballpark that was developing. But then there are other aspects which we'll talk about in terms of the rise of youth culture, the phenomenon of the teenager, the accompanying moral panics that actually sort of developed within that field. And of course, the spectre of Vietnam, which was pretty much around very much at this particular time slot as well. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the first lecture. I'll just